Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, February 25th, 2012. I'm Marcia Mary Baker, your host today, and our topic is Why Go Along with War and Famine? Stop the Bastards. And we'll be discussing those things, war, famine, the fact you don't have it, and who the bastards are. And we have three guests today for this, and I'm going to start with the guest at the longest distance from Melbourne, Australia. We're glad to welcome Robbie Barwick. Hi, Robbie.
Hi, Marcia.
And I'm glad that Robbie was able to be, it's a return visit here with Robbie, who was on last month, but he is with the Citizens Electoral Council of Australia. He may get into wanting to say something about that during the next hour, but he is their policy director and activist with them, as I say, from Melbourne, Australia. And next closest we have from Minnesota, southwestern Minnesota, Andy Olson. Welcome, Andy.
Hi.
And Andy has been a very long time, well, Andy and his family and extended family, probably Andy Farm there in southwestern Minnesota. And Andy has for decades been an activist for, in general, the right kind of agriculture, but policy at large in the world for national interests and development. And he was involved in the founding of the Schiller Institute's effort in 1988 called Food for Peace, right, Andy?
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say, and then I want to get to our third esteemed guest here, but hold on a minute, that on the question of food, it was a year ago in December, January, that ferocious floods hit northeastern Australia, and we had a member of the Citizens Electoral Council on at that time to describe the flash floods in Toowoomba, the Lockyer Valley. And it was last summer that Andy was on. He's up there right in the gradient, the divide between the Missouri Basin where the Mississippi Basin where his land is located, and the Missouri Basin, and he described that. Our Earth is very active in the solar system and in the larger galaxy, our galactic conditions. And so I'm very glad to have you guys back on because of the firsthand reports you're going to be giving. But I'm very happy to have Limari Navarette Bedford. Welcome, Limari.
Hello.
Who's from LPAC TV, and in particular, who's an editor there, people know her, but she is part of the team that has initiated a series on food in particular, but I mean in a much larger, she'll be talking about this in the largest context, and it's called Biospheric Engineering, Planetary Defense of Humanity, and the first installment of that was February 13. People can look on LaRouchePAC.com. February 13 for that Biospheric Engineering Planetary Defense of Humanity. So let me just say in introducing things here before the guests kick off the discussion is that if any of you watch Flip the Dial on your TV or anything else, you'll see even in that kind of rotten evidence that the drums of war are beating never louder. We have the London, the kind of imperial maneuvering going on in overdrive form in staging incidents and media propaganda to instigate and cover or push for a Western an attack on Syria or Iran, which amounts to the initiation of World War III. It's an attack in Eurasia is a direct attack on Russia and China. We've gone into that, and our people are, I hope, more than familiar with what's at stake here. And that's what's involved just in the last 48 to 72 hours. There was this meeting in Tunisia yesterday on Friday, the so-called Friends of Syria, which was a cooked-up thing to further this war drive. And there's been, in the last 24 hours, there's been more propaganda about the need to attack Iran based on the advance kind of information of a report from the International Atomic Energy Agency. But, in fact, there was nothing to it, but it's just part of the propaganda drive. And the backdrop to all of this, of course, is that the financial system has these piles of unpayable debts and demands for looting, which is at an untenable stage. It's only kept up by pretext. That can't last. And so the timing on this is at hand. I mean, we are in terrible, that's the danger. But our biggest problem is the non-recognition by people, or the don't tell me about this, or the inducement to the enticement of fantasy of just not facing the truth. And so we are fortunate that there are certain elements and institutions. LPAC and Mr. LaRouche personally and others are leading the charge. But, it was last Sunday that the chief of staff of the military in the United States, General Martin Dempsey, warned against going for attacking Iran, warned that this is wrong. Mr. Putin in Russia is sounding warnings. His latest one was yesterday in the town of Sarov. And by the way, Thursday in Washington, D.C., two more people, these are retired military, part of the institution of the military, retired or active, a Marine general named James Cartwright. He used to be a vice chief of staff, vice president of the chiefs of staff, and also a retired Navy admiral, William Fallon. You may recognize the name. They said Thursday night in an event in Washington, D.C., by the Centers for the Study of Strategic International Studies, this would be a mistake to be allowing a military assault on Iran. They said that outright. So these people, fortunately, are holding the line, but this isn't a line that can be held by them alone. Obama is the commander-in-chief. That shouldn't be clear why we should activate to get him pushed aside or call for get the mobilization that he's no longer in that position of power. So I just wanted to say that now, because what we're going to be discussing most of the hour is very much a part of this. What kind of prospects we have now for food, because it's totally inadequate for the near future. What the situation is with food is completely part of a kind of empire scenario playing out to create shortages and famine, which doesn't have to be. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do, put it this way, with actual with any necessity. It's in reality nature, or the human beings are the creative species, and with nation states and developing national interest and technology and science on the planet, the food would be more than plentiful. We would be going off into space where we ought to be, and we'd be well fed in the course of it. So I'll leave it at that, because what I'd like to do is have Limari, who was with her colleagues in LPAC and others, EIR, who met with Mr. LaRouche this morning and got his evaluation of things. And Limari, I'd like you to say anything you want to about the current strategic situation, but then I also want you to go into what the thinking has been in launching your frequent updates on the planetary defense for humanity. Thanks.
Yes, I'll just say that it was very good to get Mr. LaRouche's remarks this morning after having been at the USDA Agriculture Outlook conference for the past 2 days in Washington, D.C. Because obviously as most events in Washington, D.C., you'll discover are not talking about reality. In fact, this is the first time I've been to this event, and I was very surprised not to have even met a single farmer at a conference of 2,000 people for the USDA. It was
Andy's laughing.
Me. So, but anyways, I mean, this morning, Mr. LaRouche did reemphasize, the outbreak of general warfare is imminent, but that we do have a generational problem in which the last three generations, my generation, the boomer, what you'd call the tweener generation, have not actually been in a situation where the outbreak of general warfare, not the kind of warfare we've seen for the past 30 years, is about to break out. However, for his generation, the situation today would be obvious. And now, like you said, Marcia, we've seen opposition from General Dempsey against going to a war with Iran. We've seen a small group of people around him show that opposition, but again, that's a very small group of people. And Mr. LaRouche emphasized that if you do not feel gratitude at this moment for being alive to that small group of people, you really are not in reality. And then he went on to emphasize that if thermonuclear war does not break out by the springtime, then starvation will be the way that billions of lives on this planet will be threatened. Now, I just want to go back to something that we've discussed on our site, something that actually inspired me to start to look into this question of famine and food supply, which is that we're not ever looking at a situation where we're just dealing with war, we're just dealing with food crises, we're just dealing with epidemics. We're dealing with a top-down systemic approach to destroying nation states and killing mass numbers. That is, when we talk about the oligarchical principle, when we talk about the British Empire, that's what we're talking about. We have a system itself which is organized in such a way to not allow human development. And really, the more I look into the situation in terms of the food supply, how it's controlled, how famines actually occur, I don't really see a difference between what is happening today and what the British Empire has done to China, what the British Empire has done to India throughout the 19th and early 20th century. So some of the things that I saw at this conference, albeit not surprising, indicate to me a certain psychological state that the population is in. And I think that, and this came up in also discussions among associates here, that when you have a situation where you have a Nero figure in the White House, such as President Obama is, you're seeing people who otherwise understand a situation, who actually may know the causes for instance, the current crisis in food, the current crisis in the U.S. economy, but instead choose to, in fear, cower and capitulate. I mean, we've seen this in the recent days from Hillary Clinton. We saw it with the War Powers Act from Kerry. And I went to a discussion at the USDA conference yesterday on rural economic development. And it was actually quite surprising. There was somebody there from the National Association of Development Organizations who actually set his panel up with a very sober tone, which was very unusual for speakers at this event, where he said, 723 million has been cut from the USDA in the past few years on top of several other cuts, but this is not really being felt because of stimulus and because of federal disaster relief aid. Of course, we know that's not completely true, but the point he's making is we're actually, there's a delayed effect of how bad the austerity is at this point. And then he went on to say, you know, not discuss Glass-Steagall, of course, not discuss the fact that this isn't a complete attack on the American population, but instead to say we can no longer depend on the government to help us through this crisis in the rural communities. Instead, we have to move away from government, and we have to move towards governance.
Oh boy.
And anybody who has been following a situation, especially in Europe, know that that's exactly what's being described for all the nations of Europe. No more sovereignty. As you've seen in Greece, as you've seen in Italy, the leaders of those nations have been removed and have been replaced with individuals who are basically doing, doing the bidding for the British Empire. So this was really the focus of this entire discussion. How do we get rural communities to band together, you know, internally, and somehow improve their situation? And just to illustrate one example, he brought up a region of northern Maine where he said that in this region, I mean, you have, the economy's terrible, things have collapsed, but their goal is not to increase their population. Their goal is instead to improve the quality of life for those who choose to stay in the region. So you get this very tribal, regional, zero-growth response to the terror of a situation, which really it is a scary situation. But in all reality, it is the attack on the American people, the global financial virus, that has actually put people in communities like Northern Maine, like, you know, rural communities all over the nation. That has been the cause of this crisis. And I did state that very explicitly. Of course, everyone is thinking very small in this panel, needless to say, didn't have much of a response to that or to the fact that Glass-Steagall must be implemented. But you get a real sense of the psychology of just complete terror and complete fear, of the situation at hand. Now, what we want to do on LaRouche PAC TV, we just started a new show called Biospheric Engineering. And the idea of this show really came out of the fact that I was sick of hearing the term food crisis, because I really thought that didn't characterize what was really happening. And I thought food crisis is talked about in such a way that it's always there, it's always going to happen, there's always going to be some African starving with an empty bowl. And this is the kind of propaganda that I saw on TV growing up. So eventually I said, I really have to understand this from a top-down level. What is really happening? What is the progression of collapse, basically? And how is this organized? Now, myself and, with the help of others, pulled together a report on the El Nino famines from 1876 to 1900 on our website. And really what we looked at was the fact that things such as famines and crises in the food supply, they're not caused by just the lack of rain, precipitation, etc. They're actually caused by human-imposed policies that are intended to kill people. And we demonstrated that on our website. You can watch the video on the famine policy made in London. And after that, we said, well, look, if that's the actual policy, if the policy is to use severe weather events to create a system in which populations absolutely have no chance in the face of these types of disasters because of the free market system, then we actually have to communicate to the population a sense of, well, how do we overcome this and break the chains of oligarchism? So we decided to put together a show which would, number one, cover the current situation, the current stress on the food supply, what is happening, where we're going, what's taking place with the weather, but would also encompass a view of where mankind must go to make breakthroughs that would be applied to the food supply. In other words, we're not thinking of just making food better. We're thinking of upgrading, upshifting the entire economy towards an entirely new mode of operation whereby breakthroughs, such as what we will make in space, will be applied to the food supply. And we discussed that last week or 2 weeks ago in the first episode we produced, giving people a sense that it wasn't until we made those breakthroughs with the space program that finally mankind could actually get off of the ground and actually look down at their farm capacity, look down at their very large-scale farms, and get a sense of the whole. It wasn't until we made those breakthroughs that we could even do that. Now we're at the point where we're doing precision farming, where we can actually, down to the yard or the meter, actually get a sense of what a given area of crop actually needs in very fine detail. So that's one aspect of something that we already have that we need to actually upgrade. All farms should be using this. However, a lot it's expensive, and that's the only reason why a lot of people aren't. But when we get our system running, up and functioning, we get this president out of the way, we get a functioning executive And this is one of the first things that we're going to use to apply to agriculture. On top of the several other breakthroughs in space-based agriculture that we are going to bring down to Earth.
Right. Well, I'm sure Andy or Robbie can respond in many ways, both to the bad side of the imperial intervention, as you just described, or the potential, or the current conditions. Either one of you. Go ahead.
Lamari, on the question of biospheric engineering, in anticipation of this discussion, I decided to read this book that got promoted here in Australia recently called The Coming Famine, The Global Food Crisis and What We Can Do to Avoid It by an Australian journalist named Julian Cribb. And it got publicity because Australia's ambassador to the Vatican, who recently left that post to go run the big seed depository up in Sweden, you know, where they keep all the seeds in case of a disaster. His name's Tim Fisher. He gave this book to Pope Benedict as a parting gift when he left his post as the ambassador to the Vatican. So I thought it's probably worth reading. And what you see in this book is it's a very grave assessment of where the world's heading in terms of food. But you see the axioms, and there's two. There's the free market axioms, which, you know, the free trade axioms, which you can just deal with straight away. But more fundamentally, there's this axiom that the world is limited. And so it's all about what we need to do to face the challenges of a growing population, feeding a growing population in a world of scarce resources. And when you contrast the outlook to what ALPAC TV covers in the realm of biospheric engineering, you see the big difference in outlook, because they, even in terms of water, the biggest thing they say is scarce is water. And of course it's actually a bizarre notion when you think that you know 70% of our planet is water, but they have a view that assumes human beings can't do anything or change anything. And of course, if they dropped that view and actually took up biospheric engineering with a view that humans can and should change these things, then you'll very quickly lose any sense that any kind of global famine has to be inevitable, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because if you look at, I recently went and looked at some of the accounts of the famines in China, and then about a week later, then I read something that EIR wrote up about the Move the South Water North project, and I thought, wow, all of the regions that I have read about where the people were like literally dropping bodies in the street because of famine are the areas that are being affected by this new water project. So essentially what China is doing is actually bucking the British Empire by building this project, and as part of their defense. That's really what you have to think of water as. And defense not just because of severe weather, but defense because there is an intention in the system to kill people. Now, interesting, in the United States, we're the complete reverse. You know, our dry part is in the south, and we have, you know, more rainfall in the north. But it's the same exact concept. There is an intention in the United States. Maybe we haven't had those kinds of famines, but there's been an intention to prevent the development of population. Part of that is through NWAPA and depopulation of our industrial centers and depopulation of these areas, which we said as Americans that we were going to conquer, places that were seen as uninhabitable. We went out and we changed the environment, and I think that's an important concept when we think of actually building these projects.
Well, and the same thing here. I think when I spoke to Marsha last month, this came up. You know, the top end of Australia is our area of heavy rainfall, and something like 60% of the total rainfall of the country falls in just the very top band there, and it's completely undeveloped. And recently the top scientific body in Australia, the CSIRO, Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organisation, which we know its history. It was founded by a bunch of British agents in league with Julian Huxley and Prince Philip back in the 50s and 60s. So they had this outlook to start with. They recently did a study and said, we can't develop the top end into a food bowl. And their reason was because there's not enough water. And, you know, they waited for all the laughter to die down because it's just such a ridiculous thing to say. And their backup for that was to say that they went into the plan ruling out any prospect for dams because, you know, dams to catch the water because, you know, they have a wet season and a dry season, so the water doesn't fall all year round, it falls half the year. But they rule out any kind of dams to catch the water because, of course, that would damage nature. And therefore, they tie humanity's hand behind its back and expect it to fight for its future. You know, well, the result's going to be predictable.
Mm-hmm. And I have actually thought, because I've looked at Australia recently in terms of just the topography and, you know, just the climate, and I actually compared it to the Maghreb, and I was actually pretty surprised that they were pretty similar in terms of how dry. I was shocked. I hadn't really sunk in. And so when I realized that, I said, wow, this whole area of the world could really bloom, and it could really, because of where it's at in the hemisphere, it could be part of the security of the globe in terms of food supply when Northern Hemisphere maybe may see a shortage. And I was, if you have more to say on that, I've been really excited about that concept.
Well, when you see what's happening in the Murray-Darling Basin, which we've been fighting intensely for a couple of years now, which is a top-down plan to just shut it down and stop it, you know, root out its food production capability. We've been very conscious that partly it's destroying what's there, but also equally it's a plan to destroy Australia's potential, because Australia's potential is, if that one basin, and this is a large basin, but it's one of the driest river basins in the world, but it produces enough food annually to feed 60 million people, and we've only got 23 million people living here. But, you know, there's a lot of water in the basin now because of the rainfall we've had. We've had the wettest couple of years on record, so right now the basin is not dry. It's very wet, and it could easily be geared up. If the world worked in such a way that governments coordinated with each other to boost food production in certain places to make up for food difficulties in other places, this basin could be geared up now to produce a lot more food than it ever has because the water's there. It's just available. But, of course, the opposite's happening. They're shutting it down. So its potential is being destroyed. The potential of Australia as a whole, in this northern end, is like it's a real Zeus situation. Zeus is banning it entirely. You know, no way. You're not going to develop the northern end of Australia, and then every other part of established agriculture in Australia is under fire by the combination of green and free trade ideology, but especially green, because there's a commitment to locking up as much of Australia's land as possible in nature reserves. So if it's not the government doing it in league with the International Union for Conservation of Nature as World Heritage Areas, etc., if it's not that, then it's private investors funding Prince Philip's operation to buy up farms, established properties and whole stations, to turn them into nature reserves, to take them out of any agricultural production entirely. And that's just, so we've got lots and lots of that going on. It's the commitment in Australia to wilderness, the concept of wilderness. And they've got plans. The people who push this, we published a map in our most recent publication down here of their view of the future of how much of Australia's established land they'd like to turn back into wilderness. And when you look at the map, the only place that's not half wilderness already is the Murray-Darling Basin, and by the time they're finished with it, half of that will be back to wilderness. And then the other thing that bears mentioning in this regard, just in terms of potential for food that's being, the potential being destroyed, is our fisheries. You know, Australia has enormous sea territory because we've got enormous coastline. And as we speak, right now, 38% of all marine parks in the world are in Australian waters. And by marine parks, we mean areas that cannot be fished. So when I go shopping to the supermarket here in Melbourne, they pass the law, you know, I don't know, you guys probably have a similar thing. The consumer is God, right? Well, they tell us that anyway, until they kill us off. A lot of evil is done in the name of the consumer. And so they say that information is important. So when you go to buy fish, they label where it comes from. You go into an Australian supermarket to buy fish, 1% of it will be labelled from Australia. You know, the rest is from Thailand or some Asian country. Well, those countries fish their seas 20 times more than we fish ours. And we have a lot more. We have 50 times more area to fish than they do, but we've locked it all up. And there's a push now to lock up the Coral Sea, which is northeast of Australia, off Queensland there, which is one of the most pristine areas in the world. They admit it's not damaged. It hasn't been overfished or anything. It's a preemptive locking up. And when that goes through, 50% of all the world's marine parks where fishing is not allowed will be in Australian waters. And this is just totally destroying any ability that Australia might be able to muster to be a food bowl for the world, this type of approach.
Wow. Let me interject one thing here because I want to give your website from Australia, but Lamari, you're going to have to leave in a minute, but before you do, Andy may want to throw something in either. Hold that thought, Andy. Let me just say everyone listening should go to Robbie Barwick, to the Citizens Electoral Council. Website is cecaust.com.au.
That's right.
And see that map or other press releases, including one in January that summarizes everything, the key points of what you just said, this marine protected areas, swindle, this, you know, all the rest of it. But Andy, before Lamari leaves, do you want to say anything either initiating or summarize about, you're right in the middle in Minnesota of North America. Let me just stress to everyone. And we do have mass hunger here. Down in Mexico, that's our continent, our actual continent. It's contiguous with the terrible drought in Texas you have across there in the northern tier of the states of Mexico. You have a terrible corn shortage, a worldwide corn shortage. And let me just tell you, Andy, what the chief economist of the Agriculture Department said at this conference at Limari and her associates where I was there listening, Dr. Joe Glauber. He said, don't worry about the corn. He calls it tight supplies, Andy, you know. Don't worry about worldwide stockpiles being tight, because ethanol use will go down just a little bit, and this year we'll have very good yields. He called, we'll return to yield trends, even though last year we had a lot of damage. Based on what? Nothing. So go ahead, Andy. Just give some parting remarks for Lamar.
Well, I'm in the middle of food production here, as far as the coarse grains production, and we really have a wonderful ability to produce food, but one of the limiting factors is water. And our water falls from the sky, and not so much in this area is reservoirs and irrigation. So we get concerned about water, but from a farmer's perspective, to really get to the basics here, what really concerns me over the long term is the nutrition of the soil. And we didn't used to have chemical fertilization, and it was Justus von Liebig, this German, who, when he was a young boy, they had a year without a summer. I think it was 1816. And this was the galactic problem at that time. And there was a lot of starvation in Germany. So his life mission was to improve the food supply, and he was chemical fertilization, and that became his mission, and he synthesized nitrogen for agriculture and the other minerals, and his law of the minimum is called Liebig's barrel. In other words, a plant will only produce up to the minimum of the various minerals that are necessary for plant production. So we have been mining our soils, and we're only returning the minimum of the primary minerals. The secondary minerals are essentially ignored, and the trace minerals also. So in Europe, the forest 30 years ago started to die, and people wondered why this happened. Well, I don't think it was environmental. I think it was a mineral problem, that the minerals had been, the forests were logged and minerals were taken off the soil, and the soil cannot sustain the trees and so forth. This is the same thing that's going in agriculture. And when you want to get these minerals, they're becoming more and more controlled by the cartels. The one of the cartels is Mosaic, which Cargill has a big interest in. They purchased the up in Saskatchewan the potash reserves. They down in Florida, in the Tampa Bay area, they purchased a lot of the phosphate. And we know that a lot of the trace minerals like copper and so forth is controlled by the cartels, and you know they can lock up the areas, as in Australia and the Murray Darling and so forth, and then that's finished. There's no production at all. But what's left then, if the fertility of this ground is not addressed, we're gonna I believe that the autoimmune diseases, the cancers, and all these horrific diseases that the world is experiencing is because of mineral deficiency in the soils that produce the food. So this is, I would just like to add that and get the response, or we can move on to something else too.
Well, let me throw one thing in here to add. I don't know if, Lamar, do you have to leave this minute? You're welcome to, but otherwise, please.
I can stay a few more minutes.
Okay. Because one thing is thinking of how crazy it is that it's a disconnect, because on the other hand, even with all the suppression of science and retardation of technology in recent decades, you know, we should be in the nuclear fusion era at least. There are means of spectroscopy and analysis and satellite analysis of the soil. You know what I mean, Andy, soil analysis everywhere, where you could go in and rehab and create soils. But instead, you have all kinds of problems. One thing is this forcing by the world commodity cartels. They include like Cargill Mosaic or Yara, which is the biggest one in the world based in Sweden, or ADM and Bunge and Louis Dreyfus. They kind of dictate what is grown where, don't they? And so you have such intensity of production in some places. On the one side, it's very beautiful. You show what you can do. If you take the state of Iowa, which is the biggest hog-producing state, even bigger than North Carolina, I was just in the second largest hog county in Iowa, Keokuk County, for several days. And they have the farmers have done an excellent job of putting back into the soil the hog manure. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But no matter how well you do it, how you time it, how you cut it in or inject it in, there's too much phosphorus now. The phosphorus is building up because there is such an intensity of production. And so you get crazy things all over the place. I'm not taking away with Andy's specific point, but you see what I mean. But in fact, we have the technology that we could be creating soils. And Andy, I want to ask you one thing to show the problem is, since some of the soils in the western counties of Iowa or the eastern counties of Nebraska were underwater for 2 months practically, some of them where the levees broke and whatnot, they have over a foot or two of sand, and you can't just plow that under. You might plow under 6 inches of sand, you know what I mean. So that's a case where you'd want to go in and rehab the soils in a more gross way than even trace minerals. And that's, there's no resources enough being put into that, and that's our food security. Is that, do you know about that more, perhaps?
Yes, you're exactly right. The farmers, most of them, cannot afford to rehabilitate their own soils because of the deep cutting of the rushing water, sometimes 10, 15 feet deep, and it's not just sand, and this takes heavy equipment. This takes hundreds of thousands of dollars to rehabilitate, and the levees have to be rebuilt, which only a small percentage of them are, with what the Corps of Engineers budget, the austerity that the Obama administration has imposed upon the Corps, and then the environmental issue. I mean, all these problems are... they're going to reduce the production of the farmers. I would like to mention what you referenced as far as too much phosphorus in the manures in Keokuk County, Iowa. This is a result of the mining of the soils by the plants to the point where phosphorus fertilization is probably the major, one of the two or three major minerals that is applied by the farmers. So the other minerals aren't in the feed. So you're going to get a concentration of phosphorus. And this is subtle how this works. But the plants, they'll tell you what's wrong because they won't produce, or they'll produce an insufficient food. And the greenies, the World Wildlife, the Prince Philips of the world are locking up preserves. It's an onslaught against the production of food. And there was a technology that the 21st Century reported on a number of years ago about, I think it was a fusion torch, or it could separate the constituent elements by use of this technology, because it is highly expensive to mine and to move these tonnages of fertilizer around and to get them to the farmer. But if you didn't have to mine and you could use this kind of technology, it would be a breakthrough that would just feed millions and millions of people.
Limari, that sounds like something for your future, one of the programs to bring that out in the kind of isotope era of fusion, being able to have that to create these elements for food fertilizer use.
Yeah, absolutely. We do want to actually get into that. I mean, one of the things that has been brought to my attention, and maybe, Andy, you can say more of this, but it's been discussed that there's also a phosphorus crisis. This is just something I've picked up, like, in the news and looking around, that there's going to be a shortage of phosphorus. But aside from all the details about this particular crisis, yeah, what you're saying about the fusion torch fundamentally alters our relationship to our resource base.
Yes. The phosphorus is derived from the Tampa, Florida area, the ocean. The water deposited this millions of years ago. It's a source of the world has been drawing on this. There's phosphorus in New Mexico, up in Idaho. I'm sure there's phosphorus other sources in the world, but we've been the repository for the minerals, and a lot of them have been exported out of here. So I don't know as far as the shortage that we're facing imminently, but it wouldn't surprise me that we're short of these kind of minerals. And then when the environmentalists come in and shut down some of these operations, we're on a very thin edge here when it comes to nutrition for our soils. And water is critical, and one of the least recognized issues, I believe, is soil nutrition.
And one of the things, and I mean, you might find this funny, but I read an article recently about the fact that due to this phosphorus shortage, there's some sort of plant in Vienna which is doing experiments on how to extract phosphorus from human waste. And it kind of reminded me of this Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels kind of scientific approach. But when we have the capability through something like the fusion torch to actually, we can actually break things up into its constituent elements, you know, we basically can take what's considered just garbage that's in the dump and actually extract very valuable resources from it. You see, there's something really wrong that, you know, we're stuck in our own feces here on Earth, which is really what the greenie ideology promotes, rather than thinking of why don't we use the best ideas, you know, the things that fundamentally alter our relationship to the universe, and apply that to these problems.
It's also, though, the fusion torch is something that would be brilliant for this in the future, but a lot of the problems with this area of nutrients now is a function of energy costs, and they're a fraud. The price of oil goes up, and the cost of all fertilizers, that it's used as the excuse for the cost of fertilizers,
yes,
especially like nitrogen, to go through the roof. And there's no reason for it whatsoever. A few years ago, Australia came through this 10-year drought, and just when the drought was breaking, it was stunning. Here are the farmers who'd hung on for 10 years in the southern part of Australia, here in the area around the Murray-Darling, etc., that hung on for 10 years. The drought breaks, finally some optimism. You know, farmers are sowing their crops, etc., and with a view that they're going to get something this time. And on cue, and we believe totally orchestrated, the price of fertilizer just goes to the moon. And it knocked the wind out of everybody in agriculture in Australia. There were all kinds of schemes underway to try and, you know, between farmers, co-ops, to try and import boatloads of fertilizer direct from China, etc. They were so desperate. And the excuse was oil. It was the energy crisis that was used as the excuse. And so Craig Isherwood, the leader of the CEC, at that time issued a press release saying that the CEC would establish a national fertilizer company that can actually be dedicated to providing fertilizer for agriculture as cheaply as possible. And, you know, at the time, BHP, which is one of Australia's biggest, one of the world's biggest mining companies, we caught them out. When oil got to $140 a barrel a few years ago, BHP in its annual general meeting bragged to its investors that it was pumping oil for $11 a barrel,
yeah,
from Australia, and was able to sell it at the world price of $140. So Craig Isherwood just said, you know, there's no basis for this at all. Let's just produce this as cheaply as we can, because we know we can, and we can start addressing these problems quite fundamentally now.
And one thing I'll say just before I have to go is that at the USDA conference that I was at for 2 days, although I did not meet any farmers, I did meet about half of the people I ran into were into commodities trading. And I got the sense that, you know, a huge section of agriculture today is all of the speculation.
Yes.
And it's artificially raising the prices. And like I mentioned earlier about what the British has done in terms of creating famines, you look back at the history, in all of these regions where you've had the worst famines possible, all of the things that could have been done to really intervene and really actually minimize the loss of life or just rule it out completely were suppressed. And they were suppressed because it would actually interfere with the price in the free market system.
Yep.
So like I said, I don't really see that much of a difference between what the British Empire was doing in the 19th century and what is going on today. And we have to fight that just as much as we are going to think of the threat of thermonuclear war. It's the same threat.
Exactly. I know you have to go, but in the book from, I think it's from the late 70s or early 80s called The Grain Traders, which is a profile of the cartels at that time, is a very telling admission by the author of that book. And he's not doing it so much to expose them, he's just sort of reporting how things are, that the cartels have a vested interest in wild instability in the world food production. Wild instability, because that's how they make their profits. And so any idea that a government could step in with a parity pricing regime and actually bring stability to the food production area goes completely against what the cartels have a vested interest in, because they won't, they'll still make profits, obviously, but they won't make the profits that they currently make out of speculation. And it's all about, do you have a system that allows that to reign, you know, the British system, or do you put it, have a system that puts the welfare of people first?
Right. Well, thank you, Lamari. Do you have to, if you have to go, we'll do this again in the near future.
Yes, sure.
And
thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. And Andy, when Ravi was talking about this dramatic instance from the past, over the last year, I think with natural gas prices going down, but on the other hand, fertilizer soaring, you probably know how much it's gone up. Do you want to say something about that? That's just one of the many aspects of the deliberate food shortage that this is allowed to go on.
Well, the cartels are definitely trying to lock up the resources. Natural gas is one of the major seed stocks for nitrogen. Natural gas is in abundance out here. It's at, because of the fracking and the horizontal drilling, the Bakken yes. Reservoir up in the North Dakota area and in West Texas, Pennsylvania.
With the Marcellus Shale there, right, exactly.
Yeah, this is a wonderful thing for our country to get a source of energy at a reasonable cost, but the infrastructure is probably not available to take advantage of it, and it'll only be temporary, the natural gas. We still need to go to the nuclear, the fusion, and that will be a wonderful advance for society. But in the meantime, this natural gas is a great thing. But we've got these cartels. BHP was up in Saskatchewan and bidding profusely for the province of Saskatchewan's phosphate operation, and the province said, we'll sell it to you, but we want a part of this. And BHP said, no, you don't get part of it. So they didn't succeed in that. But you know that they're not going to give up on that.
No, they're giving them the Australia treatment. Excuse me, Robbie.
No, they are.
Well, go ahead.
No, well, that's you just know the way BHP thinks. You know, BHP and Rio Tinto are the biggest mining companies in the world now, and they're both heavily concentrated here in Australia. And BHP is just, you know, they're both British, but BHP they call them the big Australian. It gets what it wants. You know, it's the jewel in the crown of the Queen's Raw Materials Cartel, and it's allowed to function like a cartel wherever it goes. And so the idea that Canadians would stand in its way to BHP, that would be just temporary.
This agriculture is also impacted by biofuels. America is probably the leader in burning their food.
Yeah.
And there's all these plants around here, and I think it's consuming about 40% of the corn, although a percentage of that then goes back as dried distillers grain that's a concentrated protein that goes into livestock, but some of the livestock that have problems with tolerating it in their digestive tract. But what's being done is we're just debasing our food production system out here, and it's getting stretched further and further, and we have a situation in southwest Minnesota, northwest Iowa, in this part of the Corn Belt where the subsoil moistures are historically low. So we're going to be dependent on rain, and it's been a dependable area for food production. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here. It's sort of the reverse of last year, where there was so much water and so much flooding, and now the moisture is flip flopped, you might say.
Right. It's dry. It's how bad is it?
Our soil profile can hold about 7 inches of moisture in the top 5 feet, and we probably only have about an inch or at the most inch and a half in the top 5 feet. So we're going to need a recharge here, and if not, the consumers are going to feel the consequences. But the United States is a big area, and we can go in areas of Ohio and Indiana that are too wet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's historically been this way. So it's feast or famine for farmers. And farmers are always concerned about when are they going to bring the hammer down now? Mm-hmm. If times are good, look out. There's something's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, tell me what you think, Andy, but we're pretty convinced here that almost all of the current problems of agriculture could be solved through a form of parity pricing, i.e. if the farmers got a reliable price for what they grew that actually paid their costs, and that was reliable and they could expect that, you know, and until they didn't have to build up all their debts, etc., which get them into extreme vulnerability to the banks on the one side, and they didn't have to then fall for the scams of biofuels. Because in Australia, that's definitely what it is. I mean, farmers, like the sugarcane growers, you know, they've sort of embraced it because it's a source of income, you know, that they otherwise wouldn't get. But if you had an actual parity pricing scheme, then you would have a situation where the family farmer could solve a lot of these problems. We used to, in here, have, until a few years ago, the Australian Wheat Board. You know, we're a big wheat producer for the world, and we had the Wheat Board, which was a single desk marketer run by the government since World War II, and that's what made Australia a big wheat producer for the world. And now that's been privatized and scrapped, and all the farmers individually and now their own have to be grain speculators. You know, they've got no choice. And if we could reverse those kind of policies and they could know that for what they grew, they got a reliable income source, it seems to us that that would, more than anything else, start to address the problems in food production.
Well, when you see Glass-Steagall, what it would do to the merchant banks and the speculators, a parity price would do the same thing in agriculture to the speculators. I wonder what percentage of money is taken out of agriculture by the speculators, because when it leaves the farm gate, even though the farmer still thinks it's his grain, it has been taken over through the contracting on the speculative commodity exchanges, and they have bought and sold this and made a huge profit, and
yep.
the food is almost secondary. It's the monetary system. That's what's paramount. And it's interesting that most of the people many of the people at the agriculture conference were speculators.
Yeah, they were. I can tell you who, Mitsubishi Commodities, based in Chicago, hundreds and hundreds. There were 2,000 people there, and hundreds were involved in, you know, hedge funds from New York City, you name it. She's right.
So no farmers, just traders.
Well, what a classic example is now the milk producers, which has not been on the commodity exchanges for very long, milk futures. But it for some reason or other, the supply of milk, it seems like it's excessive. And so the price is going down, and all the commodity speculators the volume has increased on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and so there's liquidity to speculate. And what happens is that invariably there's a farmer that gets squeezed by this speculation if he's trying to protect himself.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if he speculates like the speculators and the market doesn't reward his position, then his dairy is at risk. And this is a classic empire strategy to destroy the productive food sector. There's so many areas that we are faced with that we have to deal with, but the speculation is one of the biggest. I remember a few years ago a farmer said, well, this isn't the time to feed cattle, so I'm not going to feed cattle, and then I can make money on speculation. And then he got back into cattle, and that year he went broke.
Mm-hmm.
And it was caused by speculation. And this has happened time and time again.
Well, I'm afraid we ran out of time, but you made the point. In fact, brought us full circle here, as Limari was saying, and Robbie, about the British Empire policies then and now. And that's what we're up against, including the war dangers. So I know we'll continue this on a show in the near future. And I just want to say in closing to you two gentlemen, we did have an email come in for you in advance of the show that I think you answered. But I want to acknowledge that Gerald in California sent an email about a recent National Farmers Organization meeting in Ames, Iowa, where they're based, that a fine farm leader from out west, the California National Farmer Organization activist Frank Enders from Northern California, they were concerned at this meeting about the future of food security and so forth in terms of younger farmers. We need a new generation of farmers, and are they going to understand what the American system is, as opposed to trying to get involved in this risk management called speculation that, Andy, you just described, right?
Yes.
So, Gerald, thank you. Our regards to Mr. Enders, but I think the lessons that were raised in the course of this will have to do for the answer this time. So I want to thank Robbie Barwick in Melbourne, Australia, Andy Olson in Southwest Minnesota, and this will be the conclusion of the February 25th, 2012 LaRouche Show. Thank you both.
Yes, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.